Music session number 28528, reel 15.
Tony Porson, reel 14.
When I asked Tom about his own memories of the war, he said that the saddest memory for him was so often talking to pals in the morning and finding they were dead by evening. And while he was out there, he also actually began his England career, that he was summoned back to play in an international against Switzerland and was packed off at short notice, arriving in England, needless to say, in full military dress, only to cause the FA much embarrassment because, of course, Switzerland was neutral and did not accept people in army uniform. So Sir Stanley Rouse, the secretary, had to get a taxi and rush to Moss Bros and get him kitted out in hard civilian clothes. So that was perhaps the army did in some ways help his development, not least perhaps because of the disciplines it imposed. And when I was asking him about his war, he commented on it being a very courageous thing to drive honey tanks, to which his answer was, and why did he do it? His answer was, I didn't ask to do it. I just had to do what I was told, didn't we all? But whatever he was asked to do, Finney did it very well. There were no cricket pitches in Austria or Italy, but fairly soon we did have bulldozed cricket pitches and the like. And before long, a tour was organised for a selected 15 or so to go back and play county sides or whatever back in England. This was organised by the two Bedsers, and there was a trial match. I had written in pointing out, hopefully, that as age 17, I'd made a century on my debut for Kent second 11 and had gone on to, in 2 years, an average of over 80 with them before the war intervened and set back my cricket and football careers. But that did me no good because we played on a very fiery pitch in the trial, and it only took about 3 overs before I had 2 broken fingers. And was not much good to make an impression on the selectors, and probably with the broken fingers quite clear as not to go with the team. So really, cricket didn't particularly, Austrian cricket didn't affect my future career in any way except delaying it, whereas with soccer it probably was hugely to my advantage that I wasn't finally demobbed until I was 26, and we then had an Oxford, when I immediately went up to Oxford, we had an Oxford and Cambridge side called Pegasus, which won 2 amateur cup finals before both times, the only time Wembley's been full to capacity of 100,000 for such finals. And had I been younger, or had my friends also been younger, we were a team, all pretty mature then, and that helped us to achieve what the FA had set us up for. In other words, that old thing about football being a gentleman's game played by hooligans, as opposed to rugby being a hooligan's game played by gentlemen, and a lot of the public schools were beginning to switch to rugby, and the FA's view was that if we were successful, this might help stem the flow away from soccer, and indeed it did just that. So in that sense, the army was probably helpful to me, and since the only thing I could do starting so late in life on thinking of what to do for business was to be a teacher for a time, and the only experience I'd had for that was that in our year and a half of waiting for DMOM, I'd been involved with what was called ABCA, which was the Army Bureau of Current Affairs, sending a mass of information about what was happening in the world, and we were ordered to hold seminars with our men, explaining it to them, etc., etc. So that was my only teacher experience, for which I suppose I have to be appreciative of the Army. That apart, I was not really very happy that the DMOB arrangements were centred mainly not on first in, first out, but largely on age, presumably because more people would have had wives to get back to or whatever. But to us who had gone in at 19 and were still therefore pretty young, it seemed unfair that we were kept hanging around as more and more people disappeared, to the extent that no viable rifle brigade unit remained after a bit, and I was transferred to a Welsh regiment where by then, of course, I had been promoted temporary acting unpaid major for now about 4 years without going from captain's pay, for now about a year without going from captain's pay to major's pay. And so I was put in charge of a company which had a mortar platoon who'd only just come from other regiments, none of whom had fired a mortar, and I was instructed not ever to let them do so in case they blew themselves up. Well, that was all right till we were then, and after a month, we were told that a general was coming to inspect. So the only thing I could do was to train the mortar platoon in dashing round and making apparent confident comments and recording on blackboard the short fall of shot, etc. Unfortunately, the visiting general turned out to be an artillery man and became particularly interested in the mortar platoon, and it didn't take him long to find out our complete lack of ability or knowledge anyway. So he demanded that we be sent out to a nearby field with a single tree in the middle of it and to fire our mortars at the tree. Greatly to my surprise, our first salvo demolished the tree. Judging by his previous demeanour, that was unfortunate because I think I would have been sent home earlier than I was. But anyway, we still stayed on there. And I then recorded about my final demon. Well, the last months dragged on in an area and with a unit, neither of which were of interest to me. My father was arranging for me to take up the Oxford entry for which I had qualified 6 years earlier. He was required to give a detailed explanation of how it was I had failed to take it up earlier, as the fact of the war appeared to have passed by Christchurch amid the dreaming spires of Oxford. By the time I was demobbed, my bank balance was precisely £11, half of which I was profligate enough to blow on a multi-compartmental picnic basket. So I was dependent on the government for an education grant and my very helpful father for the remaining fees and maintenance. I hoped I'd help reduce the amount he had to pay when I won a Fell exhibition as a result of my first year's exams, or collections as they were called. I was helped to do so by being given leave to play in soccer, then cricket trials, while the exams were actually being held, and allowed to complete my answers at leisure later. All I knew about the donor was a verse ending, "This I know, and know it well, I do not like thee, Dr. Fell." But I certainly liked the £13 a term grant that went with it, which I assumed would reduce what father had to pay. Not so. The government grant was promptly reduced by the equivalent amount. Welcome back to civilian life, soldier. Oddly, in 2005, I was interviewed for a TV programme on my fishing, etc., and on my war experiences, with the interviewer commenting that he too had won a Fell exhibition prize at Christchurch 15 or more years later, and the the prize amount was still £13. So at least my memory had been right on that. Yeah. While I was writing a book on my own war memories, which came about because I had been going on a 60th anniversary of the German and the Axis surrender in Tunis, which was organised as a battlefield tour, then cancelled at the last moment because of Iraq. And my family asked me to spend the 3 weeks I had left blank in starting on writing my war memories and then going on with my sporting memories. And while doing it, I have included the memories I found of several of the my colleagues at Winchester or playing cricket or whatever. But they start with one of a lance corporal who was in my platoon during all the time in Italy, and I thought that his experiences, looking at it from a different level, were of particular interest to me, and with his help I wrote a chapter on it following the starting point, which I record was the most emotive Christmas card I received in 2002 was from Lance Corporal Dick Townsend, who had served with me in Italy in A Company 10th Rifle Brigade. It read, "60 years since we landed at Bone and two old riflemen go marching on. Didn't we do well?" Townsend's real Christian names are Alfred George, but a boyhood incident ended with Dick supplanting them for all time. Since he was keen on train spotting, he used to indulge his hobby standing for hours on the wooden slatted cradle bridge outside Canterbury East Station. The coal-engendered steam of the engines passing underneath came up and so besmirched his clothes. He was nicknamed Dirty Dick, and the Dick stuck. The war first struck home when he was a 17-year-old living at home in Canterbury in a rare daylight raid with no siren sounded. A lone plane dropped a single bomb on the road along which he was walking. The blast blew him over, and he was further shaken to see a lady's body lying almost by the lip of the crater. But he still managed to find an air raid warden with whose help this Miss Ferry miraculously survived. 3 days later, another rare bomb again seemed aimed at him, as he recalls. "My parents married in 1908, both aged 21. And had 9 children. 4 were girls, 5 boys, all of whom saw some service in the war. My father, sir, had served in World War I from as early as the Mons Battle, and been fortunate to survive. We were having lunch when the sirens went, and six of us took refuge in the cupboard under the stairs. Father, however, was not going to let a German interfere with his lunch, and was killed by the falling rubble when the bomb hit our home. The rest of us survived uninjured, including a cousin who had been evacuated from London to a supposedly safe place. My survival was due to my addiction to my mother's apple puddings. I stayed behind to have a third helping, otherwise I would have gone off as a pigeon family fancier to their loft, and that was exactly where the bomb hit. After Home Guard service, Dick joined up and started by training in the Rifle Brigade depot at Winchester. He had a special liking for drill and rifle shooting, at both of which he became very good. In his short stay there, he was nominated a stick man twice in succession. This was for being the smartest soldier on parade, and was rewarded by being excused guard duty. Instead, he had the afternoon off. Life at the depot suited him so well, he grew 3 inches in a few weeks there to reach 6 foot in height, and his body filled out in proportion. After a spell at Tidworth, he found the conditions less to his liking, as 6th Armoured prepared for battle training in Scotland. There it rained so consistently, the tented camp was almost underwater. The duckboards, indeed, put down to help them over the mud, were soon floating away on top of the water. As he commented, the training was hard as it needed to be, but I settled in well with the men of A Company and soon felt a great attachment to it. There was excitement which overcame apprehension when we embarked on the Langibbe Castle and set sail from the Clyde. We learnt that North Africa was our destination and were much heartened to learn of the 8th Army's Alamein victory, and particularly of the Rifle Brigade's major contribution to it in the famous Snipe Ridge battle, where they knocked out over 50 German and Italian tanks to beat off day-long attacks on their 300 men and 19 anti-tank guns, 10 of which were crewed by their own men, the other 9 being from an artillery unit. We docked finally at Bone, he continued, and disembarked as swiftly and professionally as we had acted in the earlier embarkation. A sunken hospital ship and the bomb buildings round the harbour indicated that it needed to be done well. That impression was reinforced as heavy night bombing drove us from the glass-roofed tobacco warehouse where we were billeted to sleep on the beach, often in pouring rain. At least Scotland prepared us for the heavy winter downpours we were to experience in Tunisia. There was now a makeshift forward aerodrome at Bone, and we were told our bow fighters were averaging 4 kills a day, though the German and Italian planes kept coming. Once the vehicles were ready, the rest of the battalion headed off for the front 300 miles or so away. To my total frustration, I was left behind to guard the kit bags and baggage, of which the trucks returned much later. I was 6 feet tall and strong, a proven good shot, and the company's reserve dispatch rider after I'd taken a course when training. So I kept wondering why I should be the one to be spared to be left behind and felt unwanted. Worse followed when I was picked up. If there's one thing I hate, it's cooking, yet I found myself delivered not to my A company, but as assistant to the HQ cook. That ended in a blazing row as I shouted that I'd come to fight, not peel potatoes. At least it had the right result, and I was soon back with my mates in A company. I'd missed all the adventures round Buarada and the Argoum, But before long, our company was on the way to help stem the German tide, which had so completely overwhelmed the Americans at Kasserine Pass. By the time we got there, the worst was over, and when we joined the final defensive line in front of Tala, we still expected to get a major tank attack. All we got was intermittent shelling, then a slow follow-up down roads heavily mined as the Germans retreated back through the pass. But it was not long before I was involved in a major battle at Fondouk. When we were heavily shelled, it was the first time I had to patch up a fellow rifleman hit beside me by a splinter in the neck. So I was able to put to good use my training about the field dressings and morphia we carried. We were not as heavily hit as C Company, who had 3 killed and 37 wounded in less than an hour. But it was heavy enough for us to retreat a little, debus and send the trucks back out of range. We were told to dig 2-man slit trenches, and I was paired with the Bren gunner. I spotted a deep shell hole and suggested we dig in there and save ourselves some work. Fortunately, he was against it, and we finally started digging in some 50 or more yards away. Before we could finish, a lone plane came over and dropped a small bomb on that very shell hill. So that was my third lucky escape from a bomb. I then saw that the motorcycle had been abandoned by the rider, so I decided to ride it back to him as he had gone back in a truck. The ground was very bumpy, and the webbing with his pistol in it, which he had left on the bike, fell off. Far from any thanks, I got an angry demand to go back into the shell fire and find it. Finally, he accepted that it was not worth it for an easily replaceable revolver, particularly when he himself hadn't even been prepared to go back for his motorcycle. When we surged forward over the plain next morning, I continued as the dispatch rider, as I often did thereafter in the rest of the campaign and in Italy, being used as a relief driver. One sad sight I passed was the bodies of 3 Americans run over by a tank. There was great joy when we linked up with leading 8th Army troops near Karuan, and we were happy to pay tribute to what they had achieved. But their cracks about "where have you been all this time" and the like did become a bit of a bore. We could not help smiling, therefore, when they got stopped dead by the Axis mountain defences around Enfidaville, the type of battle the 1st Army had been fighting for months. Because they could not make progress there, 3 of their divisions switched round to our front, with 7th Armour beside us in the final drive to victory. They were less boastful after their rebuff, and we cooperated well. But they could not resist a final attempt to claim superiority by saying one of their 11th Hussar armoured cars had entered Tunis a couple of minutes before one of our Derbyshire yeomanries. Practically, it did not matter a damn who entered the undefended city first, as the bulk of both divisions swept past heading for harder fighting. This was just another example of treating the war like a rough game. But to all intents, both divisions entered Tunis simultaneously, as no one could possibly prove otherwise. Both entered different parts. There were no markers of city limits, no finishing tapes, no judges with stopwatches. Naturally, we responded with a counterclaim, and this whole city argument did in fact have important significance. It was part of the pride in performance which motivate both divisions and both armies, and played its part in the successes of both in this final battle, as in those that went before. His story continued. We had another hard time of it during the Gubelet battle, but the final breakthrough past Tunis proved much easier than we had dared expect. My main memory is the amazing sight of columns of Germans marching out from the hills after the final bombing of their positions. We were told our division took 35,000 prisoners, including General Graf von Spoening. They were mainly from elite German units like the 90th Light, but with plenty of Italians as well. For several days we had to guard this mass of men whose prisoner of war camp was just a circle of barbed wire in the plain. Just outside it I set up a bivouac with another rifleman. We dug a foot or so down inside but forgot to trench round the outside. Needless to say, it promptly rained so hard we were afloat inside. But the weather was hot that May, the water warm, and we were so happy to have done our job and lived through it. We just lay there laughing uncontrollably. For the final weeks we had kept a hen, a Rhode Island Red, in our truck, letting it out whenever there was a chance. We had got a few eggs from it, but we decided it was time for a celebratory dinner, which it became the centrepiece. The official celebrations included the battalion being paraded for inspection by the King and gained for a visit by Churchill, Eden, Montgomery and the CIGS Sir Alan Brooke. The King did stop for a lengthy talk with one of our officers, but Churchill's cortege flashed past so quickly we barely saw him. Still, it was nice to have our efforts appreciated. Churchill also addressed troops in the Roman amphitheatre at Carthage. Speaking about it, he commented later, "I was speaking from where the cries of Christian virgins rent the air as roaring lions devoured them. But I am not a lion and certainly not a virgin." As I have mentioned, I myself have no recall of these battalion parades, which I must have attended, nor of what else happened in nearly a year of rest from war. Talking with Dick did, however, remind me of my only part ever in a film, which probably took place during one of our rest periods early in the campaign. That delightful actor David Niven was a rifle brigade officer and the star of a propaganda film called The Way Ahead. As propaganda films go, it was reasonably realistic and quite restrained, and still seems to be shown occasionally on TV. For one scene, Niven insisted that it must be a rifle brigade convoy shown driving up to the front. "If you don't blink, I am to be seen in the lead carrier, standing up beside the driver with my forage cap at a jaunty angle." Fortunately, no acting was required, and it made a pleasant day out. During our lengthy rest, Dick was told his name was on company orders. Thinking it a leg pull, he took time before he went to look and found he was made up to Lance Corporal forthwith. Dick had no leadership ambitions and was appalled at the thought he might have to leave the section where he was so at home. So he asked for an interview with the company commander, who had no doubt had many such situations of men underrating themselves, and quickly had it sorted. "What is it, rifleman?" "Well, it's about this promotion, sir. I'd rather not have it." "Why not?" "Well, I don't want to leave my section mate, sir." The response floored him. "One way or another, you will. I have no room in my company for someone who will not accept responsibility or take promotion. So what is your answer?" "I'll be happy to accept, and I will do my best, sir." I can recall that he did, and well deserved his stripe. But when the Italy campaign started, he was in hospital in Algiers with an appendicitis. He was sent back with a mixed draft from a variety of units and much upset to be told they could not count on return to their own units, but might end up wherever a unit was short. Happily for Dick, A Company had sent a special request for his return, and he was welcomed back before the final casino battle started. What happened there and at Aquino, I have already described. Throughout, Dick was as reliable as ever and was one of those who helped me remove the mines after Jim Lonsdale's wounding. His story continued when we were bypassing Rome. With no opposition, we drove on through the night. In the morning, we passed the outskirts of Rome and caught a glimpse of St. Peter's Dome before taking up position several miles on. At dusk, there was stealthy rustling in the bushes in front, and I was about to fire when some goats emerged. Shortly after came the sound of moaning minis, the Mabel Burfers, headed for us. But fortunately, their bark was worse than their bite, even though they had so many barrels which fired very large mortar bombs. Much more serious opposition soon came. My platoon was involved in a company night attack on a hill crowned by a large house. This was just outside the town of Corsiano, close to Perugia. Our artillery had shelled the area very heavily, and there was no